Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, good evening, True Crime fans. Welcome back to Studio 4 and the Big Dumb Fun Show right here in Midtown, Kansas City, inside the classic old Ice House building. I am here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
We also have my good friend, Troy Cole here, retired Sergeant Troy Cole. Say hello, Troy.
Hello, Gary.
Well, we're going to continue down this path of the investigation of Robert Berdella, one of our, probably Kansas City's most famous serial killer. I don't think of any others. Richard Grissom, you know, we did the Richard Grissom story recently, and he was pretty well known. But as I noodled around, I was talking to a guy's forensic psychologist up in Illinois with the Illinois State Police. He actually doesn't work for him, but he has a contract with him. And I asked him about Berdella. He said, oh, yeah, he knew all about it. I'm going to get him on the phone. He wants to talk about the control that Berdella exhibited over these people and his need for control and the logs that he wrote. And I didn't ask him a lot more questions, but I'm going to get him on the phone here before I get this whole series done and talk to him about that. I think it's kind of interesting. Psychologists look at Robert Berdella because he's a little bit what we used to call a half a bubble off a plum, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
He's a couple of bricks shy of a full load.
The elevator doesn't go all the way to the top.
Probably he had that dead look in his eyes too, didn't he? Of a killer, did he have that kind of dead-eyed look?
No, I wouldn't call him that. He actually was a pretty bright guy. I don't know. I think if we checked his IQ, we might be surprised at how smart he was.
I'm just thinking of like eyes kind of devoid of normal human emotion, maybe. I ran into a guy like that, a couple of them on the job.
It was weird.
It was just a weird look.
Yeah. Okay. That's how I would describe him.
Interesting. Well, let's see. Where are we, Aaron? So
we're basically at the beginning of April, and Troy Cole, as the sergeant of the homicide squad, had entered Bob Berdella's house, and they searched the house. They found evidence to hold Bob for the sodomy charge and an additional evidence that brought him into question for murder. They're digging around in the backyard with a backhoe. They find a skull, a pretty fresh skull. And unfortunately, Roy Orth, the guy who's in charge of sex crimes, steps down, and Troy Cole becomes the detective, the sergeant in charge of this investigation into Bob Berdella. And at this point, all you really have is one suspect who's alive and a couple of skulls.
You got two potential victims, and you got your suspect, and he's being held in jail on a reasonably high bond. By then, I read in your book, it's $500,000.
$500,000, I think, was the original bond, yes.
So there's a lot of heat on this case. This is Sunday afternoon, Monday morning. By Monday morning, I imagine the newspapers had gotten wind of this.
News people were all over it.
And certainly all the higher command up to the chief are all over this too. And they've appointed you as the squad of a sergeant of a special squad. It'll be the Berdella squad. How many officers, how many detectives they sign you off the bat?
I think I had 11 detectives, as I recall.
Okay, uh-huh. That would expand to how many? Would that expand to more?
No, stayed with the 11 the entire investigation.
One squad, okay. Uh-huh.
But those guys had a lot of help from crime lab people and crime scene investigators and that stuff, but the actual Berdella squad stayed at 11 the whole time.
They didn't call a Metro squad on that. You know, Joe Langer talked about in the Grissom case, since it was outside of Kansas City, they called a Metro squad because they didn't have enough officers, detectives at his little department, so they called a Metro squad. This Kansas City, we don't usually call Metro squads for our own cases.
I don't recall ever calling one for a Kansas City case. If there probably has been, but not that I recall. we're considered a big enough department. We should be able to handle our own. I think so. It was probably looked at. Yeah.
So you guys were working out of headquarters and bringing some of this. You bring all this evidence that you'd gathered up at the crime scene back down to the.
No, it all
went. Wasn't hardly enough room down there.
No, we didn't bring
homicide offices.
The only thing we brought was we brought some of the paperwork, but most of the stuff went to the crime lab,
including the Polaroids.
Polaroids went to the crime lab also, and the crime lab later converted them into like 8x10, where we could have nicer, big copies to use to show to potential victims and suspects and people who could help us identify all these unknown people that were featured in the Polaroids. But yeah, they wound up turning them all into 8x10 glossies.
So did you work out of what we call the show-up room?
We started out in the show-up room. Turned out to be a nightmare. Every detective and police officer in the Kansas City Police Department wanted to come back and look at the photos. Word gets around fast.
These were the photos of the kids that are being tortured and held hostage.
Yeah, these were the photos that we had recovered from underneath the mattress in the house. And they were pretty graphic, extremely graphic, I guess would be a better way.
These are the ones with the cucumbers and the carrots, the cucumbers, sticking out of butts and
carrots,
things like that.
Yeah, piano wires. People being gagged with piano wires and so forth.
Some of those pictures are in your book, be quite if I remember right.
Yeah.
And they're out online there too, folks. So you guys want to go look at these pictures, you just Google Bob Riddell. And I don't know who snagged them. I probably just copied them out of your book because they had to come out of the police file, didn't they?
Yeah.
All those pictures had to come out of the police file.
And a lot of that they haven't really released, have they?
The file?
Yeah.
Oh, it's there somewhere in archives.
It's got to be down there somewhere. I don't know. Maybe 30 years later, it's not. I really don't know.
I heard some of them got thrown away accidentally down there. I don't know. I didn't ask for this file. I had enough online. I had you and got a couple other people that I didn't really need to go back and read the reports and do all that kind of thing. Anyhow, so you've got people interfering with your investigation.
Yeah, we're in the show-up room, which is the lineup room. And, basically, they were back there just making comments and looking at the photos, which really impeded our investigative
ability. So what'd you do?
Well, I went to the colonel and asked for a new location, and he found us an empty room up on, I think it was the third floor, police headquarters. But it turned out that wasn't very good either. It was right next to where the media operated out of. The Kansas City Star had reporters in there and paper-thin walls, so it was hard to have a confidential conversation with detectives. So that didn't work.
I bet the newspapers and the local TV people were all over this.
They were.
I bet they were firing your phone up and trying to talk to every detective, every policeman they knew that might know something, weren't they?
Yeah, everybody wanted the scoop. And but anyway, we stayed up there for, I don't know, maybe 1 or 2 days. And Colonel Jenkins finally got us a place out at 1328 Agnes, which is a satellite location for the police department. And
I think the traffic unit was out there.
Traffic unit was out there.
Credit union
and a couple other things. But that's where we wound up doing the bulk of the investigation.
You're away from headquarters.
Away from headquarters by a few blocks. And it took a few days for people to even figure out where we were out there. But a lot more privacy, and we got a lot more work done once we got to that location.
Well, I mean, over the course of these days from, say, the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, as you're kind of getting yourself situated with some working space, are they not continuing the, what you call it? They're going through the house and still looking for additional evidence? And
yes, we had people assigned to the house 24 hours a day, basically.
You had a bunch of, as you had said in the earlier episode, you had a bunch of cadets, essentially. And I thought, wasn't David Starbuck one of those cadets?
I think he was.
He
was in the academy and went out and dug.
Really?
I forgot about that.
Dug around in the backyard of Bob Riddell's house.
Yeah, he was.
I couldn't tell you who any of the
that would have been about right.
Recruits were.
1988. He could have been in the academy. Yeah, I think so. I have a hard time remembering because I knew him when he was in fingerprint ID for several years before he came on the job as a regular policeman. But anyhow, I think he did say that he was coming out.
Well, it took a few days, 3 or 4 as I recall, to go through the yard. And again, to make a long story short, we didn't uncover anything else of evidence in the yard.
Nothing else out of the yard buried?
No. Well, we did find other stuff, but nothing of evidentiary value. We found fruit jars with feathers in them. People thought that was strange. But as far as evidence of crimes, we didn't find anything else.
And by then you had all the evidence you would possibly need out of the house.
Well, no, actually we had detectives assigned to the house for probably 2 weeks.
Still continuing to go through it because there was a journal that comes along.
Yeah. When did you find that journal?
The journals were, I think they were probably found early on. I don't remember, second or third day probably.
But you just didn't know what it meant exactly at first.
We had no idea what they meant.
Kind of coded. And
it was, we later referred to them as the torture logs during the investigation. That's what we, how we classified them. But I think they were found on probably the second or third day.
Okay.
And they too were hidden somewhere in that massive mess, you know, somewhere in the house. But we had detectives assigned to the house for probably 2 weeks. They would work basically 8-10 hours a day, and then we'd have uniformed officers secure the house at night, keep watch on it, because every time we found something of what we thought was going to be evidence, we'd go to the prosecutor's office, obtain a search warrant for that specific item prior to recovering it. It turned out we had to do that for chainsaws and circular saws and other tools that were later determined to be used in the crime. So I think we wound up executing 19 search warrants during that investigation.
Where you had to go back into the house after you...
Where we had to go back in and, yes.
But actually, you were in there, another police procedural kind of a thing, even though you have custody of the house from the original search warrant.
I didn't understand that, Gary, and to this day, I still don't understand it.
If you find something else, then they want you to come go back and say, okay, while we were inside this house on this search warrant, which we found this other item that probably is evidence of a crime that we didn't specifically name in the original search warrant.
You're the attorney, and why did we have to do that?
I don't know.
I did not understand that.
I've never done criminal law.
You kind of have to backtrack and go, well, I need a search warrant for a chainsaw. When, in fact, you were originally, the search warrant was for the fact that the victim, Chris, had been sodomized and held captive, and you were really a search warrant based on kind of trying to figure out if that story was true or not.
Right, and these all were separate crimes.
Yes. An example of the search warrant would be a chainsaw. Steve Worland was going through the house one day. Steve Worland worked as a crime scene investigator, and as it turned out, was, I think, one of the key guys in this investigation. But he saw a chainsaw sitting on a back porch, and he just took out a, I think they call it a HEMA stick or something, where he runs it up in there. He thought it looked like there might have been some
blood
in it.
Right.
And took it back to the lab and tested positive, and so we had to go get a search warrant to recover that chainsaw. Again, I wasn't an attorney, and I wasn't going to fight it, but Pat Hall was the prosecutor that we were dealing with, and I thought a lot of Pat, and I certainly wasn't going to question, but I, to this day, I wondered why we needed all those search warrants.
Well, I guess in a way that makes sense, because it's a totally separate crime, but...
But we had control of the whole house.
We had control of the house, yeah.
But you're still trying to basically piece together, because, I mean, so you have a skull, you have two skulls that you're...
Correct.
The guy from K-State says these are fresh, these are not... antiquities, if you will.
Yes.
These are, you know, we said one had been maybe buried in the ground, the one that you backhoed out of the backyard itself, maybe 6 months,
a few months.
At most, the decomposition of the actual skull. But having a skull in the backyard, does that actually connect Bob to a murder?
Well, it certainly makes him a good suspect.
Right.
It's his house and his backyard, but no, you don't have any proof. There's not enough evidence to charge him at that point. But it certainly raises a lot of red flags. And the anthropologist whose name is Michael Finnegan, he was a huge help to us. He was, don't know if he's still at K-State, but he was then.
So I'm trying to, you've got all this evidence of murders happening and instruments used to cut up people. You've got pictures of the people. We just still don't know who any of them are.
Yeah, this case was backward. Usually you have victims. And you don't know who the suspect is. Now we got a suspect. We don't know who the victims are. So our biggest challenge was getting all those people in those Polaroids identified. That was pretty much job number one.
How'd you organize that? Is this where you assigned like a detective team, wrote down on a 3x5 card and gave them one picture and say, okay, find out who this is?
No, actually we had sets. Gary Howe made us sets for every detective. So we had all those photographs times 10 or 11 detectives.
Okay.
So they would take these photos out and show. They would go into the gay communities, basically. They'd go to some of the gay bars, show the pictures and say, hey, anybody know these guys? That's how we started. We got a few of them identified that way.
So by then, you knew you had talked to neighbors or other people that come forward and said, well, this Bob Berdella dude, because you need to find out about what his lifestyle had been like. And you had learned about his store at the Westport Flea Market called Bob's Bazaar Bazaar, where he sold bizarre kinds of little trinkets and, you know, like phony beads. Skulls and beads and all that kind of stuff. So you had learned that he was probably gay. You had learned that he was active in the neighborhood association. You learned that a lot of people, you know, thought he was weird, but he probably had learned that maybe he had had young boys coming and staying with him doing yard work and coming around his house and maybe working for him at the bazaar,
at the
flea market.
Correct.
Booth.
But what really had piqued our attention at this point was we had two kids, Jerry Howe and Walter James Ferris. They had both been reported missing, and they had both suspected Bob Berdella as having something to do with the disappearance, the family members.
The Jerry Howe, why don't we focus on him? That's the most interesting one.
Yeah,
probably
Jerry,
Paul Howe was his father.
Yeah, Jerry Howe knew Bob Berdella. His father had a spot in the flea market alongside Berdella's Bazaar. And so they knew each other, and Jerry used to hang out there. So Jerry knew Bob Berdella quite well. And as a matter of fact, they had had consensual sex in the past, the two of them. They had been acquaintances for a couple of years. Well, then all of a sudden in 1984, Jerry Howe comes up missing. So Paul Howe, his father, he starts going to Berdella, suspecting Berdella. But Berdella's telling him, you know, I don't know what happened to him. I dropped him off at such and such a location on the last day he was seen alive. But I don't know any more than that. But Paul always suspected that Berdella had something to do with his disappearance. Matter of fact, he used to set up surveillance on Berdella's house to watch, see what he was doing.
Yeah, it seemed like also he went to missing persons unit and pressured them to start some kind of investigation, which there's another one that, you know, a relative goes to the missing persons section and they demand that a big investigation being launched because they suspect foul play. But yet you've got somebody who has kind of a basically, alternative lifestyle that, you know, may have just decided to go out of town and not told anybody or was a drug addict or
but whatever. To missing persons credit, they actually did do quite a bit of follow-up after he had become a suspect.
Was that the one Tommy Moss, the sergeant Tommy Moss was involved in? Tommy you don't
Moss.
Want him after you, if I remember right. You correct. Do not want Tom Moss after you. And he got after Berdella.
He did.
Well, this was actually, so Tommy Moss, who was in charge of missing persons, this was really preceding, actually, the guy escaped, Chris escaping,
oh, yeah,
and you guys kind of getting into the, all of a sudden
this
you realize, hey, you know, there's something else. So, I mean, how did you kind of connect that back to the missing persons file?
Well, we did because when Berdella started making the news, he was headlines on every newscast, then that brought forth the Howe family and the Ferris family to say, hey, our kids were last seen with this guy. So at that point, it piqued our interest even more. So at that point, we started going back and looking into the missing persons investigation that they had done regarding Howe and Ferris. And but again, to the missing persons' credit, they had done a lot of made a lot of attempts to find out what they could about Berdella. They went to his house. They went through his house a couple of times. He consented once, and another time they kind of did it surreptitiously. But anyway, they didn't see anything. There was no evidence to connect him.
But he was
a suspect.
I thought somebody had said that they had actually picked up his trash at one point.
No, they didn't pick up
his trash. I think Paul Howe
may have picked up his
picked
trash.
Picked up his trash a couple of times.
The police didn't, but Paul may have.
Yeah, but they didn't find anything, and so it just kind of...
Correct.
I mean, at the point that their person's still missing, but they don't find anything, they can't necessarily continue to pursue that lead.
Just kind of hit a dead end, basically,
yeah.
Yes.
And so you're just searching for something. You don't know what you're even searching for, and you're really doing it under his consent with him standing there watching. You're not going to really be able to do the kind of search that needed to be done that maybe would find those pictures or something along those lines.
But then Paul Howell comes back around because his son was missing.
Yes. He and the Ferris, members of the Ferris family, Ferris's wife and mother, they both came to us and said, hey, we think he had something to do with the disappearance. Well, in going through some of the paperwork, we find a driver's license of Walter James Ferris in Burdella's house, and we find photographs and paperwork belonging to Jerry Howell, newspaper clippings regarding Jerry Howell's missing person case. We find all that in Burdella's house. So now the evidence is starting to mount, and he's becoming a pretty good suspect in regards to the disappearance of Howell and Ferris.
And so both of these young men were the kind of men that might be one of these street prostitutes.
Yes, they both lived that lifestyle.
Yeah.
Ferris was married, but he was bisexual, and Jerry had consensual sex with Bob off and on for a year or two prior to his disappearance. So they both were.
During that time, I guess I was in intelligence unit, and for some reason they gave me the job to go out and ask around and find out, see if I could identify any men that were going out and cruising these hot spots for these young kids. And I never forget, I lived over in Midtown, and I identified the guy who had a little corner grocery store right around the corner from my house. And I thought, oh, well, now I get it. He'd always have these young men working for him in that grocery store. And there was just something wasn't quite. And he'd tell me these stories about, he knew I was a policeman, and he'd say, well, you know, he said the other night, he said, I picked up this young man downtown. And I was going to give him a ride home. And then he wanted me to take him to a drug house, and I refused to do it. And then he tried to rob me. And he said, I carry a gun. He said, you know, he said, I jumped out, and he said, I fired 3 rounds off up in the air, and he ran off. And I'm thinking, why are you telling me all this? And then it made sense.
Right. He jumped out of his own car.
You know, that guy jumped out of his car. That kid jumped out too.
Is that why that you came up with the term fruit hustler?
Fruit hustler. Well, that's a long time term.
Owned a store.
No,
chicken
hawk, fruit hustlers.
Well, so you really
just the street terms.
So what you had was the couple of pieces of physical evidence. You had the photographs. Your detectives went out into the community. 70 and 88. I don't know if the sidekicks and buddies would still be there. The local, you know, gay saloons, if you will, and
it was Joe's downtown.
Was it
back
Joe?
Then, this is long before those places. It was called Joe's downtown.
Joe's and Midnight Sun were two of the
places. Yeah, and so they go out and they're showing these photographs, and probably the people in the gay community, they knew Bob. They probably had seen everything on TV.
Correct.
Were there people coming forward?
No, I don't. Well, we may have gotten some phone calls, but it was we didn't get a lot of cooperation. Let's put it that way.
Other than Paul Howell, who was Jerry's father,
yes,
and the family of Walter Ferris.
Right. His mother and wife both were pretty adamant that Burdella had something to do with it.
But there's still actually in the list of victims 4 more people.
Yes. What we did at that point, the only 2 people we knew that had been reported missing that might be that the skull and the head from the backyard might belong to Ferris or Hal. So that was the first thing we did, was to check dental records. Well, turned out
it wasn't either one of them.
Didn't belong to either one of them. So we're back to square one. That was kind of a big disappointment, because we in the squad, we felt like chances are one of them would be either Hal or Ferris. But so it was kind of a setback to us at that point. So
yeah, because if that skull had been either one of them,
then you got him. Then
you're on the way
to getting him anyway.
You still got a bunch of unidentified people primarily.
Yes.
You're still having a hard time connecting him directly to any of these murders. So I guess you continue on trying to identify these young guys. That was the biggest obstacle
after doing that, and once in a while we'd get a lead or a tip that, you know, somebody would call and give us a name. We'd run that lead down, and these leads took us all over the country. We wound up sending detectives to Miami and Las Vegas and Omaha, Des Moines, Tulsa.
Because these guys are real itinerant.
Yeah,
they'll go from one city to the other.
They don't spend too much time in one city. But
and when they live one place, they won't even have their own address or their own driver's license or their own, you know, utility bills or telephone or anything. They live with other people or some kind of a flop house or hotel or something. Boy, that would be tough.
It was tough. So anyway, after doing that for a matter of, I don't know, we did that for probably 2 or 3 weeks. We decided to crop the photographs to where we would just show the face and put it in the newspaper and on the local news TV. And that generated hundreds and hundreds of phone calls. But it did. It led to the identification of all of the unknown victims that we were, or the unknown people at that time. They weren't all victims. But it led to identification of all the people. And but again, that took weeks in order to run all those leads down and get them identified. So once we got them identified, then we got to go out and interview them. Are they still alive? Were they a victim? Or were they just a friend of Bob's and their picture happened to be made? Were they having consensual sex? Were they tortured? So all those things had to be done, and everybody had to be interviewed individually. And that, again, that took, as it turned out, about 3 months.
3 months. Mm-hmm. So you'd go out and you'd interview somebody that identified out of the pictures, and they'd still be alive.
Yeah.
So I guess you'd have a name. You'd go out to interview, like Robert Sheldon or Mark Wallace, and you couldn't find them anywhere.
Couldn't find them.
Now, were you able to kind of, using those interview techniques of even the people that were alive, would they have maybe known some of these other people
victims? They in turn were a big help. Some of them were, because they, having obviously been in and around Berdella's house, they knew some of the other people. So it was a combination of things, but eventually we did get them all identified.
Now, the guy whose head was you found buried in the backyard in Berdella's garden turned out to be Larry Wayne Pearson.
Correct. He was the last victim of that Berdella had killed.
So how'd you get him identified? I guess that would be one kind of case study.
Well, before we got him identified, we got Robert Sheldon identified. He was the skull in the closet.
Oh, okay.
With the teeth in the envelope. So he was our first murder case. So
you found some relative or something of him or his or friend.
We found paperwork in the house that identified him. We got people to identify his photograph being tortured. We
were you able to find dental records then?
We eventually got dental records and got him identified. We also found one of the torture logs. We had 7 torture logs in all, and one of the 7 belonged to him. So
was his name on each torture log?
No, the names weren't on.
Did they have the initials?
Or? Hal's name was on his torture log. Ferris's name was on his. But some of the others, once Bob confessed to all this, he was able to show us
which one
this
was
belongs
which.
To okay. him and this belongs
but
to him.
But so you have 7 torture logs, but 6 actual victims.
Yeah. And that became a stumbling block until Berdella confessed. And in his confession, that 7th torture log turned out to belong to a dog. He had taken in a stray animal and was experimenting with the drugs on the stray animal to see what effects a certain amount of ketamine or chlorpromazine or whatever drug he was injecting them with. He used him as a test case before he started injecting humans.
Now you're assuming that he's actually being honest and that, in fact, was a dog in the torture log, although nothing... Why would he be putting cucumbers and carrots in the dog's rectum?
Well, he didn't say he put cucumbers and carrots in the dog.
He just experimented with the drugs on the dog.
He was just experimenting with the drugs.
It makes sense. Yes. You know, I'd believe it.
Beforehand, so he could get a sense.
But again, you're right. We had nothing. We had to believe him or take his word for it. We had nothing to prove or disprove anything else.
He didn't have anything to gain or lose at that point in time. You'd already made the deal.
At that point, he would already... set for life with no parole.
So Sheldon, Ferris was the head in the backyard, and Sheldon was the skull, vice versa.
No, Larry Pearson was the head in the backyard.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And Robert Sheldon was the skull in the closet.
Okay, and you got dental records for both of them.
We had dental records for both, and they were both, that's how they were identified.
They were the first to be identified? Because you still have no body.
Sheldon was the first to be identified. And once we got him identified, we wanted to get a murder charge filed. Mm-hmm. That was our first goal. And so we needed to show cause of death. So that became a stumbling block. Yeah, we've got a head in the closet with some teeth pulled out of it in an envelope. But how are we going to prove how did he die? what caused his death.
You have to have a cause of death, don't you?
You have to have a cause of death. So people smarter than me decided maybe we can show that he had too much. He was injected with too much drugs. He was injecting all of his victims with ketamine, chlorpromazine, acepromazine. These are all animal tranquilizers.
This is just to sedate them.
Yes, to get control of them. And with the torture logs, we could show how much he injected because he took such detailed notes. In other words, he might show 6 cc's of chlorpromazine at such and such a time, and then he would show on the torture log, he would show what reaction the victim had to that. So they thought, well, if we can take the torture log that belongs to Robert Sheldon and show over a period of time how much drugs was injected, have the skull tested to see how much drugs remain in the bone.
Oh, that's a real CSI stuff there. So then scientifically.
We took it to a St. Louis lab. Gary Howell, again, was our lead on that. And Gary said there's a lab in St. Louis that I would recommend. So we took Sheldon's skull down there and had them run some tests on it. And they come back and they said, you know, he's got a massive amount, but we can't say that this caused his death. So we're kind of between a rock and a hard place again.
Well, it's one more little peg in the coffin.
At the same time, what you really don't want to do is bring forward any evidence that may cause a conflict to getting a murder charge. Like if they came back and said, yeah, it was definitely this concoction of drugs, then you would definitely run forward with it. If in the case where they came back and said, well, he had a massive amount, but we can't say that killed him, don't you kind of back burner that evidence, if you will? And then
it's a piece of evidence. It's not, you know,
it's not the damning evidence.
It's not the big one, but it's a piece. And then in addition to that, with the lab, they took the skull and the vertebrae that was with the skull, and they could show that there were saw marks and that a circular saw that we recovered from Berdella's house matched these saw marks. So, but again, he could have died of natural causes and then he cut his head off. So, you know, it was one of those tricky things where, and Pat Hall, you know, Pat Hall was a great prosecutor, but he was a stickler. He wanted everything in place before he filed a murder charge. And
he wants to win a case.
Yeah.
The last thing you want to do is have
you don't want to blow this one, do you? Yeah.
But eventually they did. They went ahead and charged him with the murder of Robert Sheldon. So
you never came up with a smoking gun kind of evidence?
No, we never did.
Now, you had found the logs, or at least you said there were 7 logs.
We found 7 torture logs.
And so you're kind of trying to determine which one maybe fits for Sheldon.
We found a log that we thought matched Sheldon, and I can't remember now exactly what it was on there that led us to believe that. But we did.
But and then you, I guess my question, or what I'm trying to discern here is, you have Bob Berdella incarcerated.
Yes.
You have no free reign to go back and question him?
We
above,
do.
Above and beyond the time that you've spent talking to him before?
But he didn't have to talk to you.
No, he doesn't have to talk to us. But we did. There was an FBI agent who was a criminal profiler who they brought into the case to assist us. And he thought we should bring Berdella down to our squad room where we were working and kind of overwhelm him with the evidence. Put up all these big 8x10 blow-ups of stuff, pictures of stuff that we had recovered out of his house. Bring him down and put him in that setting, and they thought, well, he'll feel like he's the big man on campus, and maybe he'll confess.
Did he call him Mr. Berdella and all that kind of be kind of subservient to him?
They did.
Trying to make him feel like he's a big shot?
They did.
Well, he must know something's going on because, I mean, at this point, if you've been investigating for 3 months or so beyond when you actually apprehend him and kind of hold him, you have to continue to hold him based on a charge, or be it the sodomy, or you're developing a case for murder. You didn't just let him, you set a high bond, he couldn't make the bond. He must have known that, I mean, you guys are working a case against him.
Yeah, he was aware. He was aware of the investigation, and he was still being held on this $500,000, which there's no way he could make that bond. But
Although they were a little worried about that. That's a whole other story.
Worried about him selling the house and being able to.
You only have to come up with like 10%, right?
But
if you can get a bondsman, it'll take it too.
Yeah, that was another part of it. But he forgot where we were.
So where you're basically at is you've got the evidence that you found that this is Robert Sheldon.
You have
a circular saw that has blood on it that kind of ties it back to that at least Bob Berdella dismembered this body. On circumstantial evidence, and as you said, the prosecutor, he wants a case he's going to win.
Correct.
But that was enough. He filed the murder charge.
He filed
the
murder charge.
You put a big bond on him then.
So when you had Bob in the squad room and you're overwhelming him with evidence, he still didn't say anything.
It didn't faze him at all. Basically, after a few minutes, he said, "Fellas," he said, "I've had enough of your games." He said, "Take me back to jail." In so many words, he really had no... he had no desire to talk to us. So
the profiler wasn't quite as good as a profiler.
He didn't profile as good.
Apparently, it works better in D.C. than it does.
It works better in D.C. or on TV
CSI,
than it
maybe.
Does in real life. Yeah, that's always, you guys out there may not understand or know this, but the criminal profile business has gotten very popular. It was kind of a big deal and got a lot of publicity. But yet the guys that go out and work the case, the men and women that go out and work in these cases on the ground and gathering real evidence, they're a little bit disdainful sometimes of these criminal profilers because the criminal profilers come in, act like they know everything, and they don't know beans most of the time. And they come with generic stuff like, well, this was probably a white male.
19 to 25.
and he probably lives in another city.
Drives a pickup,
yeah. And say, whoa, look what I did. But they always get an immense amount of publicity.
Actually, the guy who was in charge of the criminal profile unit back in Quantico, he was flying from San Francisco back to D.C., and he heard about the case somehow, I'm not sure, and he stopped in Kansas City to lend his expertise, and he wanted to go out to Berdella's house. And somebody drove him out there, and he looked around, and he come up with this in a matter of minutes, what kind of guy Berdella was just by walking through his house. And he told Pat Hall, he said, well, I can testify to this, this, and this. And after he left, Pat didn't think he had any need for him.
He didn't call him back to testify.
Was not going to make his case. Well, maybe we should take a pause here.
Okay.
We basically got ID'd for one of what is six known victims. Two victims that are at this point still unknown. I mean, they know him by name, Jerry Howell and Walter James Ferris, which both of them actually just missing persons that are connected to Bob Berdella. And then you have a case now for a murder charge for the murder of Robert Sheldon.
Correct.
So why don't we take a pause here because we're over 30 minutes and people's commutes might force them to sit in the parking lot at work. To continue to hear this instead of waiting till the next episode.
But on NPR they have a term for that. That's the driveway moment, where you're listening to something that on NPR that is so engrossing that
we've all done it.
You sit in your driveway until you listen to the rest of the show.
Yeah, well, when the bases are loaded and two outs, and you can't turn
it
off.
It's like in the ninth inning.
Well, I mean, you've basically got our driveway moment is here is getting Bob Berdella back down to the squad room, presenting a whole bunch of evidence to him, hoping to break him. And he says, take me back to my cell.
I'm not playing your games anymore, fella. Aaron, for some reason, this all reminds me of my public service announcement. I have long supported the nonprofit First Call. If you have a friend, relative, child, grandchild, spouse, parent, or coworker, anybody that you care about that has a problem with sex, drugs, or alcohol, or any kind of obsessive compulsive behavior, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900, the 24-hour-a-day hotline. Or if you're outside the area or you just want to more anonymously find out about them, go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org.
And if you're listening to this episode with our special guest, Sergeant from the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department, Troy Cole, go out and get his book, Rites of Burial, a true crime story about Bob Berdella from the man that worked the case. And then when you're also online, remember to rent the documentary or buy it that started it all, Gangland Wire, available on Amazon, and download the Kansas City Mob Tour app for $1.99. You can take your own personal guided tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. And remember, we need you to help us out with Gangland Wire, because the studio and the equipment and the web hosting aren't free. What we'd really like you to do is to put a hit out on our donate button.
Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron. Say goodnight, Troy.
Goodnight, Troy.
Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.